Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
I'm glad to be sitting in for Rabbi Goldberger. This week is Parashas Truma, and Parashas Truma introduces us to the story of the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Now, the truth is that was incorrect, because it does not introduce us to the building of the tabernacle. It introduces us to the command to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And that command is in Parshas Truma. Next week's Parsha, Parshas Tetzaveh, will include with it the command that goes out to the different Kohen vestments, the vestments, the different garments that the Kohen, that the priest, the high priest, would wear. And that is the entire discussion for next week. We will have indeed a repetition. Thank you. We will have indeed a repetition of these different commands at a later point in Vayakhel and Pekudei, which seem to be a direct repetition of these two parshas, but I'll leave it for Rabbi Goldberger then to understand why it's repeated seemingly verbatim. But the discussion for this week is I apologize if your pages are marked up. That is my own personal markup. I did not have the original to be able to copy it in a way that does not have any notes all over the place. Some people would pay more money for the pre-marked up sheet. Other people would say, who drew all over my sheet? I'd like to draw all over it. So feel free to join whichever camp you feel comfortable in. But this is a handout from a book. You notice on the top left, Sabbath Shiurim. Sabbath Shiurim is a compendium of three volumes collated from the lectures that were presented by Rabbi Mordechai Miller. Rabbi Mordechai Miller was a rabbi in London, and he started the Gateshead Teachers Seminary in Gateshead, England, of which my mother attended, and my wife. So, it's particularly meaningful for me to be quoting Rabbi Miller. Rabbi Miller was one of the primary disciples of Rabbi Dessler. Rabbi Dessler of Michtav Me'Eliyahu fame, the big philosopher, thinker, and developer of Jewish thought in the 20th century. So, without further ado, we jump in to our handout. Everybody have them? Great. Okay, so you know what, just before we even jump in, let's just give a basic general introduction of what the topic that we're going to be discussing is. The topic is a fundamental difference of opinion between two of the Rishonim, two of the earlier commentaries. One of the difficulties that many people encounter, especially beginners to the study of Chumash, is how is it possible to have numerous understandings within the text itself? And if you agree that there are numerous ways to understand the text, why does that not allow the flexibility of any interpretation to somehow find itself wedged in to the text? And without spending an entire class on this, even though it's probably worthwhile to spend some time on it, essentially the difference is how loyal to the text are you? If you have to use a shoehorn to get your theory into the wording of the text, it probably is not what the text means. That's pretty much the bottom line. And therefore, the text itself was written in a way to allow for numerous interpretations. The sages tell us that there are 70 faces to Torah, which indicates that there are 70 layers of meaning. And all those layers of meaning are all accurate. Two different readings of the text can both exist at the same time, even if they seem to be opposites. Paradox is always the vehicle to profundity. Whenever you have a paradox, that means that a simple mind can't process it because it seems like two opposites. However, all it is really just a doorway into a much deeper way of understanding things. And the paradox is, in and of itself, the little flag that says, dig deeper, and you'll work out a way of merging these two seemingly opposite ideas. And indeed, today's discussion will present us with a seeming, I wouldn't say paradox, but clearly a difference of opinion, both of which don't seem to be able to coincide or work dovetail with each other. And Rabbi Miller, in this particular class, does a brilliant job. He does not need my stamp of approval, but he does a brilliant job taking seemingly two opposite opinions and merging them into each other. Okay, and without further introduction, let's jump in and we'll discuss it as we go along. So, page 118 at the top, Parshas Truma. This week's portion deals with the building of the tabernacle, the sanctuary, and specific instructions are given in precise detail. Ramban, Nachmanides, explains the reason why the command to build a sanctuary was given at this juncture. I won't bother reading in the Hebrew. The English says, God has spoken directly with Israel when giving the Ten Commandments, and he enjoined upon them, through Moshe, a selection of representative mitzvos, a procedure similar to that imposed by our rabbis of old in the case of proselytes who come to be converted to Judaism. So essentially what he's saying is that Parshas Yisro was the giving of the Torah, the parsha that recounts the giving of the Torah at Sinai, and then Parshas Yisro, which is purely narrative, transitions into Parshas Mishpatim, the next parsha after that, which slams us with an entire litany of do's and don't do's. And it's almost like you need a seatbelt and an airbag just to deal with, you know, the change of pace of the Torah, where everything was kind of like nice and fluffy. You know, it was all nice story, until, do's and don't do's. And the Parshas Mishpatim does not incorporate all the mitzvahs, just some of them. Well, what exactly was the purpose of introducing the Jewish people to these particular laws at this juncture? And Ramban tells us that indeed, just like the conversion process of today requires there to be a basic understanding of the convertee, or one who is converting, to have some basic understanding of what they're about to get themselves into. So you don't need to go through all 613 mitzvos, but you need to give a sampling of the mitzvos to give a general context to have an appreciation of this person, to realize this isn't all about nice, warm, fuzzy feelings about being Jewish. This is a commitment to a way of life that is quite rigorous and disciplinary. And Ramban says that in the same way, the Jewish people experience the giving of the Torah at Sinai, and then they're thrust into a clear realization that this way of life requires them to act. To act and to not act in certain ways, and only then will they firmly be part of the covenant of Sinai. So, that's what's happening in Mishpatim. After Mishpatim, we have Truma, we have the discussion of the tabernacle. So what is the transition from giving the Torah, giving a sampling of commandments, and then building this home for God, as it were? So, continues Ramban. Israel undertook to do all that he would command them through Moshe, and he made a covenant with them on all this. Now they had become his people, and he their God. As he had stipulated originally with them, if you will hearken to my voice and observe my covenant, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now they were holy and worthy of a sanctuary in their midst, so that the divine presence should abide among them. So essentially, the people agreed to join into a covenant with God. God said that if you are deserving, I will rest amongst you. They clearly earned the right to have God, so to speak, lower himself to this world to exist in this physical world, to invest it, to inject it with spirituality. So that is the timeline. Yisro, the giving of the Torah. Mishpatim, a sampling of the commandments for which the Jewish people had to agree to accept. And of course, if they would accept these, then the understanding is that they are committed to accepting other things. If you want to be part of this relationship, these are the requirements. If you agree, great. If you don't, that's your prerogative. Jewish people agree, and by doing so, earn their right to have God live amongst them, and therefore, the next logical thing would be to create a place, a sanctuary, for God to rest His presence on the Jewish people. Okay? Pretty straightforward. So, in summation, bottom little paragraph on 118, according to Ramban then, the building of the sanctuary was the achievement of the ideal that had been marked out for Israel. This is it. They finally made it. With all the trials and tribulations and all the ups and downs, they finally got to where they need to be, part of a covenant with God, allowing God to live amongst them. Beautiful. We can call it quits right now. However, Ramban is not the only early commentary. He is one of the classics. But Sfarno, the Italian commentary, has perhaps a little bit of a different approach. And in the commentary of Sfarno, we see a contrary attitude. He says in the translation, "And so you shall make the sanctuary in order that I shall dwell among you, to speak with you, and to accept the prayer and service of Israel. This is not as it was before the sin of the golden calf, where it was stated, 'In any place where I shall have my name mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you.'" What is Sfarno saying? Sfarno is saying it is a very interesting thing. We have a parsha dedicated to the story of the sin of the golden calf. After the episode of the sin of the golden calf, we have another two Torah portions that are dedicated to building the Mishkan. It almost seems that there's a non sequitur here. Two parashas with a command, two parashas with the implementation of that command, and one wedge in the middle, the sin of the golden calf. Was the command to build the Mishkan before the sin of the golden calf? Is it in chronological sequence? Or was the command to build the Mishkan after the sin of the golden calf? And we'll have to explain why there is a anachronism over here. It's shifted out of sequence. That's the ultimate question that Ramban and Sfarno are dealing with. According to Ramban, it's beautiful. It's a seamless transition. Sinai, acceptance of the covenant. Let's build a home. God will settle. Sfarno says, no. This is not as it was before the sin of the golden calf. Before the sin of the golden calf, the Torah states that in any place where I shall have my name mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. Does that sound like one isolated locus of spirituality? No. That means everywhere. Every individual, every home, everywhere has the potential of having the divine presence settle on it. It says the Sfarno, but after the sin of the golden calf, now God says, build a sanctuary. So according to Sfarno, it's exactly the opposite. If the Jewish people would have merited that high level, they would not have needed a sanctuary. They wouldn't need one place dedicated for this. They would have it everywhere. It would be ubiquitous. Wherever they would go, they would have access to God. It's only because the Jewish people, on their exalted level, downgraded their level of sanctity through the sin of the golden calf. That's how we end up with the command to build the Mishkan. So Ramban says it's chronologically sequenced. Sfarno says it's actually out of order. Even though the sin of the golden calf comes after the command indeed took place only in the wake of that failing. Okay? Let's read on. Several chapters later, Svano reiterates this idea. A sanctuary had to be made, and the Torah makes it clear that this happened as a result of Israel's evil choice. For at the end of the first 40 days, God gave the tablets made by himself to sanctify them all as priests and a holy nation, as he had promised. But they rebelled and became corrupt and fell from their high spiritual level. So it's clear that the Sforno's approach is that there was a massive spiritual shift, a paradigm shift that now created a new reality in the Jewish people. And that shift reflected itself in the command to build the tabernacle. So, in summation, we see from the above passages that Sforno maintains that the building of the tabernacle was commanded only after the sin of the golden calf. Ideally, the sanctity and proximity of God were to be experienced everywhere. But owing to their behavior in connection with the golden calf, which showed that they needed a more tangible expression of God's imminence, they built a, we'll call it an idol for lack of a better term. They built a physical image because apparently they needed something that they could see, that they could experience in order to connect to God. Well, Jewish people, if that's how you feel about the relationship, well, it's not a punishment, it's a consequence. As a direct result of their choice, God reflects that new stage and says, fine, instead of just being out there, let's build a physical structure within which we'll have different furnishings, we'll have a Kohen going in there, we'll have real tangible stuff that you could relate to. It's apparent that that's what you need. If that's what you need, that's what you'll get. God, is that the ideal plan? No. That's not what I had envisioned. I had envisioned everywhere. Everybody has equal access, no matter where you are. You don't have to go to a particular place to access God. But it's due to their choices that God consequences them and therefore tells them to build a Mishkan. Yes?
Why did you say it was like an idol? That the sanctuary was like an idol?
Not the sanctuary, the golden calf.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
It's not clear that it was an idol, but it seems that they desired some tangible method through which they can connect to God. Yes?
As an analogy, the small parcel of land that we call Israel is really just a small representation of what is to eventually take place.
True.
The entire planet, and this is a small area where the laws are enacted. And we're adhering to whatever we can at this status in, you know, state and time.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
We eventually wake up and grasp it.
The sages say that all blessing comes to the world through the land of Israel. It emanates, it comes down from God to the land of Israel, and the world benefits from the overflow. Interesting concept. Okay. So far we have Ramban that tells us that the Mishkan, the sanctuary, is the ideal state of the Jewish people. Sforno says it is the exact opposite. The ideal would be do without it. Now, unfortunately, we need it. Two classic commentaries seem to lock horns with each other. Now, could the text yield both readings? The answer is absolutely. Even though it seems strange to us that it's out of order, we have a rule that many different segments of the Torah aren't necessarily presented in chronological sequence, so that's not a problem, but now's not the time to discuss that. But a careful reading of the text could yield both of these understandings. The challenge is for our minds. How can we synthesize these two understandings into one unified whole? Yes?
I was reading somewhat recently about Hillel and Shammai and how Hillel expresses how we live in the world as it is at the present time, and eventually we will evolve spiritually to be able to discipline ourselves to the realm of Shema.
Right. It seems like opposites, but it's really talking about two different stages. And we'll see if perhaps this discussion as well can relate to that distinction. Excellent. Okay. Moshe brought down the original tablets, the work of God, written by the finger of God, so as to sanctify the whole people as priests. But because of their sin, the priesthood was confined to the Levites. That is another major shift in the Jewish people. Up until the sin of the golden calf, every home had the opportunity of being a mini sanctuary. If you had a bechor, if you had a firstborn male in the house, he served as the in-house kohen. Fascinating. It was only after the sin of the golden calf that that was shifted away and now dedicated to one tribe, the tribe of Levi, specifically the Kohanim, were the only ones that now could serve in the temple, the only ones to benefit from all the gifts. Okay? We had to outsource it. Why? Because, like the Sforno said, prior to the sin of golden calf, it was accessible everywhere. And every household had the possibility of being that mini sanctuary. But it's due to the downgrading of the Jewish people's level of sanctity that now everything changes. We shift into one physical place, and we shift into one particular group amongst the Jewish people. Interesting. So, as Rabbi Miller states, Sforno's approach seems difficult to reconcile with the many prophecies that speak of the restriction of the one sanctuary in Messianic times. So again, the Sforno is saying that the building of a temple, the building of a tabernacle, is a non-ideal in the Jewish people. If that's the case, then we have a problem. Take Isaiah's prophecy. Isaiah says that I shall bring them to my holy mount and give them joy in my house of prayer. This is God talking about the world after Mashiach comes. So God is saying, I'm going to take the Jewish people and we're going to give them the Beis HaMikdash, the third Beis HaMikdash. In Ezekiel, whole chapters are devoted to a description of the future temple. If the ideal is for there to be a sanctuary everywhere and for all to be priests, why is this not to be the situation in the ideal state of Messianic times? It's an obvious question on the Sforno. Sforno, you're saying that the tabernacle and the temple are non-ideal. Well, if it's not ideal, what happens when the Jewish people achieve their ideal? And Mashiach comes and the entire world graduates to the high level of spirituality that we're supposed to reach. So if it was an ideal to be everywhere, then why would God provide us with a third temple? Seems rather counterintuitive. In fact, the difference of opinion between Ramban and Sforno as to when the command to build the sanctuary was originally given is already found in earlier authorities. Rashi, like Sforno, maintains that although the command precedes the golden calf in the text of the Torah, the command was actually given after the sin of the golden calf, whereas the Zohar, like Ramban, places it before the golden calf. Okay. So it seems that we have a few pretty fundamental questions to deal with. Number one is, here we have two opposing commentaries that seem to be at odds with each other of whether or not the Mishkan was a reaction to or preceded the sin of the golden calf. That's number one. And number two is, if the ideal state of Jewry is to be achieved in Messianic times, why, according to Sforno, is there going to be a temple? Okay? I don't presume anybody would like to hazard a guess to answer this. These are a bit difficult. Yes?
Without having some kind of delineation, everything can be in a state of chaos. And until you can get some clarity, or you can get some focus, you kind of bring it in. Again, just like the little parcel of land, you have to be able to, we have to see it. We have to see what, even if we don't see God, to see His intentions so that we can relate to it. It's very difficult to transfer something verbally. It has to be seen, just like the Jewish nation is here as a physical example in all the laws that we maintain. They can be viewed.
So are you...
Maybe it transfers, it's able to transfer that way. We live in a non-physical entity that lives in a physical entity. We are part and parcel of a physical world. And we also, we have to make the connection of the spiritual and the physical. And otherwise, we'd just still be flying in space. And He didn't make it that way. He put us here for this purpose.
And that was the challenge of the generation of the sin of the golden calf, to be able to traverse that gap without having to rely on something tangible. So apparently there is some inner struggle over here with where the ideal is and what God expected of them. But that's for perhaps a different time. Thank you. So, where do we go from here? So Rabbi Miller introduces us to a passage from the book Shem Yishmuel. Shem Yishmuel was written by a Hasidic Sukkachover Rebbe, whose name was Rabbi Shmuel Borenstein, 20th century. And the Shem Yishmuel quotes a Ramban, quotes a Sfarno, and approaches it in a way that unifies both. The Shem Yishmuel endeavors to reconcile these apparently divergent views and to explain the opinion of Rashi and Sfarno by means of the following argument. Had the children of Israel not sinned in respect of the golden calf, they would have lived like Adam before his sin. That's a statement of the sages, which is a pretty wild concept, which could probably derail us for the rest of the session, so I'm going to discipline myself and try not to talk about it. But essentially, there are many commentaries that compare the rationale of Adam in motivating him to go against God's will, which clearly requires an explanation, to the sin of the golden calf, what motivated the Jewish people, and the subsequent consequences that came about in the wake of each are very much parallel. So there's clearly some association between the two. The world... Yes?
If Adam had not done that, there wouldn't have been a Jewish people, would there? Wouldn't we have gone just straight?
That's correct. In fact, I give a class on Wednesday nights in Bereishis. So in 2 years, we've done 11 verses. And surprisingly, there are still people that are hanging on. So you know, anytime somebody asks a question about Adam and the sin, so I say, you know, in a couple of decades, when we get there, you could ask your question. And if you're not around, your children or grandchildren can ask it. Just leave it in the will, you know. But the notion of the playing the what-if game, you know, what if Adam would not have sinned, what would the world look like? And the sages seem to say that the world would have reached its perfection, and that's it, game over. We wouldn't be around, we wouldn't need to be around.
Right.
It's a pretty grim look at things, but thank God he did what he did. And I was just having a conversation with somebody last night. He said, which world was better, the world before Adam sinned or the world after? I said, that's a great question. I said, what do you think? I said, well, the world before Adam sinned was a wonderful world, and he destroyed it. So I said, let me ask you a question. I said, somebody tells you that he is a loyal individual. So he said, really, that's so interesting. How does your loyalty express itself? So they say, well, you know, there's an individual that I'm always at their side. Whenever they need anything, I am there. Wow, that is pretty loyal. And then, all of a sudden, you were speaking to him on the phone, and then all of a sudden, the person shows up with this other person that he is loyal to, and he notices that there's a chain wrapped around both of them about 8 times with a huge padlock. Unfortunately, their last name is not Houdini, so they're having a very difficult time getting out of this lock. So all of a sudden you smile, and the person says, what's so funny? And says, you were explaining to me that you're loyal because you're always there. The reason why you're always there is because you're locked. That's why you're there. I don't call that loyalty. So the person agrees. Yeah, but you can't call that loyalty. You call that locked into being next to someone. So I said, before Adam sinned, Adam was locked into a relationship with God because there was no wiggle room to get out of that realm, out of that relationship. His awareness of God was so great, his level of spirituality and clarity was so great, that it was a no-brainer. After Adam ate from the tree and lowered the entire world into a state, a stage, upon which there are many distractions and many temptations, and then Adam chooses God from amongst all his options, would you call that loyal? I would. So I said, the world before Adam's sin may have appeared to be a better world. But after Adam's sin, the world became a world custom-tailored for our mission. So if you want to call something good or not good, you're going to have to define your terms. And you're going to have to understand that good is appropriate. Right? If I have a saw that cuts diamonds and I'm trying to cut wood, that's not a good saw. Why not? It's perfect for what it's there for. That's right. It's perfect for its use. It's not perfect if I have some other goal in mind. So the world was perfectly calibrated for our mission after Adamson. But that's a different story, and I'm sorry I derailed myself.
Well, I think I derailed you, but...
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. The onus is off me. Okay. So the Shemesh Mol says that, according to the opinion of Rashi and Sfarno, by means of the following argument, he says that had the children of Israel not sinned in respect of the golden calf, they would have lived like Adam before the sin. What does that mean? The world itself would have existed in a different and less earthly form. If you're having a hard time envisioning it, good. You're in good company. Rabbi Dessler, Rabbi Miller's teacher and mentor, quotes a passage in Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner's Nefesh HaChaim, another classic work, 20th century, at Mount Sinai, before the sin, they heard what was usually seen and saw what was normally heard. Now, they didn't have equalizers in those days. It's very difficult to see sound. And what does that mean that they heard what was usually seen? It sounds like a confusion of the senses. What's going on? That is to say, says the Nefesh HaChaim, the material senses were so vitiated and their perception refined to such an extent that all material things previously appreciated through the sense of sight could no longer be perceived as physical objects. So in other words, they reached the level where physical reality did not really have that tangible form that we are so used to. They saw what was normally heard, meaning they had clarity in non-tangible things, and those things that were tangible, they now began to hear instead of to see, meaning that they couldn't use their normal senses of a physical world to perceive these things. In other words, there was an altogether different reality than that which we're used to. Okay. The principle is then associated by the Shemesh Mol with a statement by the Rambam, Maimonides, in the section of his work, Yan HaChazaka, the 14 volumes of the corpus of Jewish law that Maimonides wrote. And this particular section, deals with the construction of the temple. And he writes that the building King Solomon built is already explained by Scripture in the Book of Kings. We have an entire chapter dedicated to all the details of its construction. But the building destined to be built in the future, though mentioned in Ezekiel, is not explained and interpreted. That's all Maimonides says. King Solomon's temple, all the details are mapped out. In Ezekiel, the temple of the future? Nothing. Is there mention that there's going to be one? Absolutely. No details? How are we supposed to know? What are we supposed to do? Can somebody help us out here? Something which is entirely spiritual cannot be described or envisaged by us mortals. That's it. That's the explanation. Something spiritual we cannot relate to. It is out of our realm of experience. For this reason, there is no description of the world to come in the Torah. The big question that everybody always wonders about. Immortality to the soul? The soul continues in the next world? Why didn't God mention it? Well, what exactly is God supposed to mention? Like, it's like Dave and Buster's. When you go, you get a bunch of tickets, and then you cash it in for, like, a pencil eraser. You know, it's like, what is the world to come? Well, you see, it's like this. It's like, I don't really have any way of explaining it to you. Oh, okay. So don't. Now, what if God just attempted to? Would that, like, what would he use as analogous? I mean, when you're talking to a kid, you talk in terms of how much candy. You mentioned some grand amount of money, $10,000. To a kid, $10,000 is a meaningless number. Why? Because they don't have a concept. They don't have any a baseline point of reference to be able to judge how much money that is. If you tell them, you can buy 1,000 gumballs with that. Wow, that's a lot of money, right? Or upgrade it. You tell a woman, how many pairs of shoes can you buy with $10,000? Or a guy, how many smartphones can you buy with it, right? So everybody has their, you know, position, their reference point to be able to relate to things that they cannot relate to. But when you're dealing with spirituality, there is nothing that can be used, no terms that could accurately describe anything because we live in a purely physical world.
All right, so our Torah and our laws and Shabbat, I mean, is this all not supposed to be what I call a Vorspeis? Just a taste, just to let us know. And without it, we would have no inkling. We just, you know.
I say with it, we have no inkling. It's a start.
It's a difference. If I live outside of the Torah versus me living inside the Torah, it's an enormous difference.
There's no question.
I can't even begin to express the
That's
difference
correct.
In it.
That's correct.
So, to me, that sheds a little bit of light on, you know, what a difference, or, you know, to have some type of differential. Without it, without having the spiritual connection versus having the spiritual connection, that it's...
Right. Now, if you had to explain, now I always ask people the following question. Everybody knows that when you do a good deed, when you really dedicate yourself to someone, especially when it's inconvenient, you walk away from that situation feeling positive, good, fulfilled. Just... Yeah, that's it. Now, imagine... You look at your watch and it's 12 p.m. and you're sitting in front of your computer and you're in the middle of work and you're in the mood to just, you know, have a little fun, and you start clicking at different websites and you look at trivia and Yahoo, and you check your mail and you check your mail again, and then you check your mail a third time just in case somebody may have sent you something, and oh, in between the two clicks, maybe somebody sent you something this time, right? And then you look at your watch and 2 hours have passed. How do you feel?
Depressed.
Depressed, empty, worthless. Now, the feeling of emptiness that comes from wasted time and the feeling of fulfillment that comes from time invested in something positive. If somebody that you're communicating with has never experienced that positive feeling to motivate them to do worthwhile things, how do you explain to them the feeling of fulfillment? Hmm. Go ahead. 300-word essay. Try it. I guarantee you won't get past the first sentence. Why? Because it's impossible. It is impossible. The only reason why all the people sitting around this table are nodding when I say that is because all of you have experienced it. You know what the feeling is. You know that you can't articulate it, but you know it exists. So you have some point of reference to be able to relate to it. Go ahead, try to explain that feeling of, I don't know, it's like you feel empty. What do you mean empty? What does empty mean? I feel fulfilled. Oh, really now? Like, is that after you eat or before you eat? There's no way to describe it. In the same way, as much as we perceive some differences, we cannot relate to a world where everything is spiritual. And therefore, the Torah doesn't even bother describing anything in any detail because it's just not worth it. And indeed, Maimonides says, the temple in the times of King Solomon, every last measurement was spelled out for us. The temple of the future, nothing. Why? Because the future Beis HaMikdash 2 will be entirely spiritual, for even the materials of its composition will be endowed with a spiritual quality. In this vein, our sages say that it's going to be rebuilt with fire. Does that mean like, you know, we're going to have these soldering irons? No. What does that mean it's going to be built with fire? I have no idea. And anybody that claims that he does, stay far away from. Such, too, was to have been the sanctuary which God desired to build in the midst of Israel after the Torah was given and before Israel sinned. There was supposed to be a sanctuary. And that sanctuary would have fulfilled the ideal state of the Jewish people. When they were still like Adam before the sin. An ideal sanctuary which we can scarcely comprehend. Okay? In this sense, there was, before the sin, a command to build a sanctuary, a sign of the high spiritual level of Israel, as Ramban Nachmanides says. But, on account of their sin, the nature of the sanctuary was changed, and its structure was lowered to their level when the command to make the tabernacle was given after the sin of the golden calf. So in other words, the Shem Yishmol is taking these two opposing ideas, one of which says that it happened before the sin of the golden calf, and that's the ideal, and the Sforno that says it happened after the sin of the golden calf, and it's the ultimate non-ideal, and fusing them together by describing that they're both describing one side of a coin. It's the same coin. One is the high ideal of the Jewish people before they sinned, and one is the low state of the Jewish people after the sin. And in both situations, we have a Beis HaMikdash, a temple, a tabernacle being built. So, in both situations, the tabernacle is being built. So, you know, we're left with a question of how to deal with early commentaries, and even not early commentaries, even later commentaries. Taking them and trying to understand how both can be true at the same time. And the Shem Yishmol, indeed, takes the Sfardo, takes Ramban, fuses them together to understand how they both could be true. Let's just continue towards the bottom of that paragraph over there. The temple of Solomon was likewise sufficiently worldly to be within our comprehension. All right, Maimonides tells us that all the details of its construction were told to us. Why? Because it was a type of temple that was on a lower level. If it's on a lower level, it's more physical in nature, and therefore it can be described in physical terms. Whereas, but the future temple, as envisaged by Ezekiel, will have the lofty spirituality of the sanctuary as originally planned. Thank you. For which Moshe received the original tablets, the work of God written with the finger of God, the very stones being of celestial nature. Now it's very interesting what he's describing here, because we know that the tablets were brought down, and as soon as Moshe saw the Jewish people involved with
the golden calf,
what happened to those tablets? They were broken. Did they receive a backup?
Yeah, but he had to write them.
That's right. Qualitatively different. He, Moshe, had to provide the physical stones, and only then God would invest those physical stones with writing. The first set of luchos, the very stones themselves were provided by God, which means that they were on a much higher level of sanctity. It wasn't as physical as the second set. Now listen to what he says. Beautiful. Those tablets, the ones that were the work of God written with the finger of God, the very stones being of a celestial nature, were broken by Moshe. But their fragments were placed in the ark by the side of the second tablet. Now, it's intriguing because the Talmud tells us that when Moshe threw down the luchos and broke them, the letters that were miraculously embedded into the stone flew off of the stone.
Like that rabbi who was tortured, and he said, "What do you see?" And which rabbi was it?
Rabbi Akiva, right?
And he saw the letters flying off.
That's right. The letters, which were the soul, as it were, of the stone being more related to the body, as it were, the soul left the body. And as some commentaries describe it, it almost seems as though there was dead weight in the stone that caused Moshe to have to throw it down, because the life force left it. Why? The same way the Jewish people were now relating more to the physical than the spiritual, the luchos that they were about to receive had to reflect their new state. So the letters fly off. Now, if the letters fly off of the stone, what's on the stone?
Nothing.
Nothing. So now we have stone that's broken with no writing on it. And then God tells Moshe, you know that ark that's going to go in the tabernacle? You're going to put the full second set of luchos and the broken pieces of stone from the first set. Is there any writing on those stones? Is there any significance to those stones?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, because God...
There is. Why?
Hashem is the one who made the stone.
Aha. Uh-huh. So in other words, the significance of the stones was not insofar as they served as the basis of the writings, because these stones were provided by God, and therefore they represented a world where physicality is more translucent, we'll call it, than the crass physical world that we live in. And therefore, God tells Moshe, make sure those pieces of stone are sitting right alongside the other luchos. The other luchos are physical in nature. Moshe provided the stones. Those are real stones from a real physical world. Those are going to fit in the Aron, in the ark. But make sure that you have those other stones, even though they're broken, even though there's no writing on it. Make sure they're sitting right next to them. Why? Take a look at what he says. The breaking of the tablet and the lowering of the status of the sanctuary must have caused anguish to the penitent Israelite. Longing for God can come either from pure and joyous love, as was the case with Israel before they sinned, or from broken-hearted contrition at the sins of the past, as was the case with Israel after they sinned. Yet the fragments of the broken tablets in the ark indicated that not all of the original sanctuary was lost. Though the wholeness of the tablets was wrecked, the fragments remained, and they offered hope of a future sanctuary whose wholeness and unsullied sanctity would once more be restored. So in other words, it was always alongside the Luchos to remind the Jewish people that you may have failed, but that doesn't mean all is lost. There are points to aspire to regain the world prior to the sin of the golden calf. And as such, the first set of Luchos, the very stone of the first set of Luchos, is in and of itself that lesson indeed. So again, in a nutshell, Sforno Ramban, each one has an understanding of the sanctuary. One of them says that it's the ideal state of Jewry, and the Sforno says, no, it's a non-ideal state of Jewry, because God really should have been everywhere. The Shem Yishmol merges the two together, explaining that in essence we're dealing with two levels of Mishkan. One, much more ethereal in nature, more spiritual in nature, and one much more physical. Yes, before the sin of the golden calf, there was a command to build the sanctuary, because in the ideal state of Jewry, they deserve to have a super spiritual place to have God dwell in, as it were. But after the sin of the golden calf, a new command went out to build the Mishkan, because indeed this second time around the Mishkan that's going to be built is going to be an altogether different building than the first time around, and that is a much more physical building with less spirituality in it. However, even within that lower level sanctuary, there is a residual element of the first original planned sanctuary in the form of the broken pieces of stone from the first tablets. And although nobody was able to go into the Holy of Holies except for the Kohen, so you would think, like, maybe you should have it on display. Whenever the Jews would make their journey to the Mishkan, they would be reminded of that. But in a certain sense, the Kohen was the one that served as a spiritual leader of the Jewish people. And indeed, it was the leadership that had to recognize that there's hope for reconciliation and achieving the ultimate goals, and that will inspire the rest of the masses. So Sforno, on one extreme, that says that it only came after the sin. Ramban says that the command went before the sin. And the Shem Yishmol does a beautiful job in reconciling these two approaches into one unified approach to understand that there are always two levels, an ideal and a real. And even if we can't achieve the ideal and we have to live in one that's practical to live in, we should never lose sight of an ideal that we can still strive for. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
You just did.
Can I ask another question?
You just did.
Well, the question is...
That's okay. I tease people all the time with that. I'm sorry that you were the sacrifice.
I heard that we're never going to be able to atone for the golden calf, that all through the years we, like, because God didn't take it all out on us at one time, Is that also?
You just said two separate statements. Right. One, you said that the punishment, the consequence, has expanded throughout the generations, and the other statement you made was that we can never reconcile.
So that's my
that
question.
Failing.
Can we reconcile?
The answer is yes.
And in the
there
book,
is
the
no failing that cannot be reconciled with God.
Wow.
God is a loving God. God does not want, as the verse says, God does not want us to die because of our sins. God wants us to repent, to discover the errors, and to rethink it through, and to get back on track. God does not like punishment. It's not punitive in nature, it's educational. That's why it's direct consequences, which are most educational. Because, you know, if you tell a kid that I will not call out in class, and you tell them to write it 1,000 times, you know, that's called cruel and unusual punishment. Why? Because what does the punishment have to do with the
crime?
You want the child to recognize that interrupting in the middle of class is not pleasant for the teacher, not pleasant for the student. So, you know, perhaps it takes a little ingenuity to come up with a consequence such that maybe while the kid's talking, you interrupt them. And
yeah,
get
I thought you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to go back and be... That to me, I don't know. We're not supposed to show our children like they did this and we should do it also.
No, but what you're doing is you are actually educating through example of showing them the very behavior that they have done but lacked an appreciation of what they truly have done. So this gives them a real way of connecting to it and they realize, yeah, it is frustrating to talk and be interrupted. Perhaps. Again, I'm not a master educator, but all I'm saying is punitive punishments are not necessarily educational. When you take a guy off the street and you lock him up behind bars because simply he or she cannot live amongst society, you know, that's punitive. You are limiting their access to the very elements that have perhaps they have abused. But now you release them. Are they any better off?
No, you have to educate them.
Right. Obviously, whatever was done was a symptom of a deeper problem. Is there anybody counseling them? Is there anybody discovering what the real issue is? Is anybody providing them with skills to be able to live among society without having to resort to these behaviors? No. So what do you expect? And how many recurrences are there with criminals that have been released and find themselves back where they started? It's much more convenient to live in a world where everything is mapped out for you, all your meals are delivered, doesn't require you to do anything. All of a sudden you get back into the world and you say, how am I supposed to survive? Well, I did a good job before I ended up in jail. Let's see if I can get away with it this time. Yes?
The word stone, if it is the same as oven in the father and son connection and this passing this on from generation to generation, that it may not be a matter of do what I say, but copy what I do. And I don't know, perhaps we weren't at that level. And when I see the term, the golden calf, and I see calf, it doesn't say the golden cow, and it doesn't say the golden bull. But when I see calf, it looks to me like when the world was young, before we knew anything differently. And this is what we did then versus this is what we do now.
Interesting.
So perhaps we had to, you know, we learned so much through experience.
We most definitely do.
We live through each and every minute detail so that we would know actually both sides of the coin. We would know the pain and suffering versus we would know the pleasure.
I live with the following maxim. Good judgment comes from mistakes, which come from bad judgment. That is one of the most important ideas that you need to live with and communicate to your children. Failure is not inherently bad unless it doesn't lead to reflecting on what caused that failure and taking the lessons and improving from it. So... And I walked into the store this week, and the person said, can I help you? I said, yes, I'd like to know if you sell something. They said, what would you like? I said, I would like some experience. So he said, sir, we don't sell that. So I said, do you give it for free?
He really did that?
And he said,
to just a clerk, this is so funny.
I walked into a flooring decor right off 85. So I walked around, you know, everybody's looking around stuff, and I'm like, I'm not interested. I could buy whatever's on the floor. I don't need help with the items. I need help with knowing what people do wrong, knowing people do right, how to install it, not to install it. So the guy said, well, what do you want to know? So I said, well, I said, let's say I buy this particular kind. I said, can you tell me the number one mistake that everybody does when installing this stuff? He said, yeah, absolutely. We get calls all the time because the people, they have a hard time clicking the laminate into each other, and they take a hammer and they bang it, and usually they snap off the little ridge, and then it ends up not being functional. So I said, great. And he said, and they always call up to complain about the junky material that failed on them.
You walk out of that place because it's all junky material.
So I said, okay, that's the mistake that they make. Now, what would you recommend? So he said, don't use a hammer, use a rubber mallet. I said, oh, of course.
Free experience.
So I said, great. I said, now, what do most people come back to the store a second time for because they didn't realize they needed, but they only realized they needed it as soon as they put all the stuff down and they realized that, I'm missing something.
Experience.
He said, oh, yeah, people usually come back for that little box because you need the spacers. I said, great. So he was amused and then I turned to him and I said, did I not ask any question that I need to ask in order to know what not to do and what to do? So he said, no, actually you covered everything. I said, wonderful. So he said, you know, you're an interesting customer because most people think they know what they're doing, and they just assume that, and then they come back with their tail between their legs, and they admit, you know, that I made a mistake, or I botched up, or this and that. I said, yeah, why should I make the second trip? I might as well get it all in on the first trip. So he said, very smart. So, huh?
I bet he had a good story
not
to
yet.
Get home.
Not yet, but at least I know what mistakes people make, and that's a wonderful question to ask.
Oh, yeah.
What mistakes have you made so that instead of me having to learn from my own, I could use you as an example?
Wow, that was cute.
So this was a paid commercial for flooring. Call Rabbi Friedman. Rabbi
Friedman, you said a couple of things that I just want to clarify.
Yes.
You said that before the golden calf, either before the golden calf or before Adam HaRishon, we were supposed to, every home was supposed to be like a temple, and the oldest was supposed to be like the priest.
Right.
But you also said that we were commanded before to have a sanctuary and afterwards. So why would we need a sanctuary before?
Good. Excellent question. So clearly the opinion that says that it was an ideal of the Jewish people, if it came before the golden calf, what was the ideal? The ideal was to be able to have a high-level sanctuary. A high-level sanctuary perhaps limits the particular individuals that can gain access to that temple. You know, there's always this question of, do we do something Ivy League and elite and limit access to it because we're trying to bump up the population to a high level of academics with a chance of losing some? Or do we lower the standards and open up the opportunity for everybody, no matter what their level? And it makes for a very fascinating discussion. Because on the one hand, you won't have top people in their field and leaders if you open it up to everyone and dumb down the materials in order to allow everybody to access. And at the same time, you know, you don't want it to be too exclusive because that will leave everybody in the dark. So how do you deal with that? That's a good question, and I'm not here to answer it. But clearly both need to exist. So
the home as well as the sanctuary needed to exist.
That's what it would seem like. And it would seem like even in the home, not everybody would have the same level of access. It would be the oldest, most responsible, perhaps a higher level of spirituality within the home that would be the conduit. So even within higher or lower levels, there is still a limitation, because there is always going to be a limitation. As soon as you refine it, it requires a certain adaptation to that refinement. Excellent question.
A lot of floors with an elevator, because with respect to me, the best way to communicate with someone is to speak to them in their own language. So to speak with a person where they are.
Right. You know, I'll share with you an interesting statement of the Maral. The Maral says that the word for analogy, or a parable in Hebrew, is a mashal. I may have mentioned in this context. And the word for king is melech. But there's another word for king as well. And the other word for king is a moshel. A moshel is what we would call a totalitarian despot, a dictator of sorts. And so we have the word for king, melech, the word for dictator, moshel. The letters mem, shin, lamed also mean a parable or an analogy. You know, things are not haphazard in the Jewish language. And therefore, if the same three-letter root is used in one context and in an altogether different context, there must be some underlying connection between the two ideas. And the Maral tells us that indeed they are connected. Because what is the goal, what is the role of an analogy of a parable? The role of a parable is to be able to communicate something that is out of the realm of this individual, and to be able to package it in terms or experiences that are within the experience of the listener, the student. And the more accurate the connection between what can be experienced and what has never been experienced, I have now a connection. I have some leverage, some foothold in the concepts that were just seemingly so out there. Now I have some way of relating to them because there was an analogy or a parable used to make that connection. So the Maral says that the concept of a king is a leader. The concept of a dictator is one who seizes control over someone else. It's a negative concept. But the Maral says that in the world of ideas, the ability to grab control of an elusive concept is actually a positive one. Because before you were able to wrest control from this thing that was just out there, you had no access to it. And now you've pinned it down and are able to control it through the use of the analogy. So the analogy serves in the same way that a dictator serves. It's just that a dictator is doing it without permission. And the analogy is not just being done with permission, but its specific purpose is to be able to control an idea that was heretofore elusive.
Good. You just have to hope for a benevolent dictator.
Have a wonderful Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.